This is why we dance. My father told me, anger is a luxury we cannot afford. Be composed, calm, still. Laugh when they ask you. Smile when they talk. Answer them. Educate them. From Mohammed El Kurd's poem, This is Why We Dance, Palestinian poet, journalist, and activist. His family has for years been staving off settlers trying to take their home in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem. This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. In this episode, we consider issues related to Palestinian refugees in the occupied territories of Palestine. In 1947 and 48, more than 700,000 Palestinians fled their homes in response to sometimes lethal violence perpetrated by Zionist militias. During the 1967 Six-Day War, more Palestinians fled. Many ended up in what is now known as the West Bank. Others fled to the area now known as the Gaza Strip. Still others fled north to Lebanon or east to Jordan. In this episode, we hear a conversation between two men with differing narratives about Palestinian refugees and differing views on when or if refugees should be given the right of return to their homes in historic Palestine. Our guest, Alan Edelman, is a native of Kansas City. After receiving a master's degree in Jewish education, he served in a number of professional capacities in the Kansas City Jewish community, including congregational educator, regional director for the conservative movement, and executive director of the Central Agency for Jewish Education. Beginning in 1994, Alan served as associate executive director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Kansas City, until he retired in June 2017 to devote more time to volunteering. Our guest, Alex McDonald, is a Quaker committed to the values of freedom, democracy, and equality. He was raised a Zionist. In the early 2000s, following a journey of discovery, he became an activist promoting an accurate understanding of the history and current situation in Israel-Palestine and for the support of human rights for all, including Jews and Palestinians. He has published two books on the subject, How I Learned to Speak Israel, An American's Guide to a Foreign Policy Language, and When They Speak Israel, A Guide to Clarity in Conversations about Israel. Alan and Alex, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine. We are here today to talk about the Palestinian demand for the right of return. So, Alan, if someone told you that this right of return is based on international law and is non-negotiable as far as any final resolution, what would you say?
I would say, like many conflicts around the world, this is really complex. And you have to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a 100-year-plus situation with periods of cooperation and working together and periods, obviously, of war, of conflict, of terrorism. And it makes it difficult in a democracy for an electorate to support a policy which could put the population at risk. And when you have certain governments that don't necessarily address the issue, you know, and of course, each time there was a war, more certainly in 47 and in 67, more people became refugees. And so it's difficult. And in the Oslo negotiations in the early 90s, when we were getting as close as we ever have come to resolving this and having a two states for two people, there were negotiations regarding the right of return and a certain number of Palestinians, you know, every year that could come back, just so it wouldn't be a burden to the government that was to the Palestinian government that was trying to to build a society. It's not easy to integrate a whole bunch of immigrants at one time. So I can't remember what the numbers were, 25,000 a year, something like that. So, you know, at the time, before all that broke down, certainly the Israeli government was, you know, understood that there needed to be, you know, a right of return. You know, there's sort of two levels, one of which relates to the West Bank and Gaza, which could theoretically be a Palestinian state. And of course, what used to be known as Arab Israelis, who before 47 lived in Palestine, and some of them left. So, you know, their right to return to homes that are in Israel proper, if they were to be in Israel and a Palestine, how about those people being able to return to their homes in what's, again, considered Israeli territory, would always be Israeli territory.
Alec, what would you say?
So the way so first of all, I must say, I look at this from an American lens. I'm not Israeli, I'm not Jewish, I'm not Arab, I'm not Palestinian. And so I look at very much the issue from the perspective of what do I want the U.S. policy to be towards Israel and the Palestinians, and what are my values? My values, you know, I hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal and have inalienable rights. I happen to be supportive of international law for the overwhelming part, and the right of return is part of international law. This is not something that Palestinians demand. It's something that is, by definition, a right. If one has to negotiate for it, it's no longer a right. I like to frame the issue in terms of the position that this is not something that Israel has a choice of. It's not something, it's something that they're denying. They're violating the human rights of the Palestinians. And the problem is not the Palestinians. The problem is that Israel has taken land that was predominantly Palestinian Arab, and they want the land without the people. And that's the issue for, as Alan mentions, and I completely concur, this is an issue that's lasted a century, more than a century, in fact. And the overwhelming international law that relates to this is that acquisition of land by force is against international law. And so the problem is, as Alan mentioned, in 47 and throughout 48 and early 49, the Zionist militias then became the Israeli military, took land by force in 1967, continued to do so, and today continues to do it throughout the West Bank by the expulsion of Palestinians. And the problem is all that is violation of human rights. And so my big concern is, I think as an American, I really can't stand behind a state that is dependent on its identity as one that violates human rights of an ethnic group.
When you say you can't stand behind a state, could you elaborate on that?
Well, Israel is the number one recipient over time of U.S. foreign aid. So I think that's inappropriate to support a state so extensively that is dependent, or that has, since the day of its declaration of being a state, violated human rights. Our number one recipient of vetoes in the Security Council is Israel. And overwhelmingly, they are protecting Israel from condemnation for their human rights violations. So I think that's inappropriate as an American. And then finally, it's our military equipment and assistance that's used to also violate human rights. Rachel Corrie, an American from Washington State, was killed by Caterpillar bulldozer that we supplied, but, you know, an Israeli soldier driving it. The bombing of Gaza that's become a regular event is, you know, with American jets, with American weapons that we are quick to replenish. And so anyway, that's what I mean by U.S. support.
Alan, what would you say?
Well, you know, again, I would emphasize the complexity of the situation. Unfortunately, I don't justify it or say it's right, but unfortunately, throughout history, when there's been war and conflict, land has been acquired from Native, even in our own country, of course, what we've done to the Native Americans, you know, that wrong hasn't been righted entirely at this point. I applaud the organizations that begin their meetings by recognizing what Native American lands that their offices are sitting on, and that's a wonderful recognition. But, you know, like I said, it's extremely complex, and to make peace with people that and Israel's bombing of Gaza, of course, is in response to missiles fired into Israel. So, you know, it's not a one way situation here. And, you know, throughout Israel's history, they would have jumped at the opportunity. And as I said, Oslo came as close as possible to being able to do it. And the response in the end, you know, was some of the worst terrorism in the Intifada that Israel has ever experienced. And the murder of men, women, and children in restaurants, on buses. So again, it's complicated. And I have many Palestinian friends who disagree with that kind of terrorism and recognize that it didn't go very far and didn't help in trying to negotiate. So again, it's complex. And to be critical of one side without recognizing that it takes two to tango I think just a little unfair.
I'm happy to respond to that. Alan raised a number of points that I want to address. First one was the land by force, and that it's been unfortunately part of history. I would acknowledge and agree with Alan 100% that it's been part of history, but the key delineation, I think, is starting in 1907 with the Hague Convention, followed by the UN Charter and in the Geneva Conventions. All of those clearly state the inadmissibility of taking of land by force. So yes, before those time frames, it was sort of the Wild West or law of the jungle, whichever metaphor you prefer. And Israel is a signatory to, obviously not the Hague Convention, since that predated its existence, but of these treaties since then. So I have a little bit of a problem with admissibility. We are still complaining about Russia's annexation of Crimea and of parts of Ukraine. And if the law of the jungle holds for Israel, then why are we complaining about Russia's? Second issue was that Al brought up was the complexity. There are many, many aspects to the situation there. But the fundamental one is very simple. And the simple fundamental part is that Israel is a Zionist project. And Zionism is a movement of one ethnic group whose purpose has been to take over and control a land where other people lived. And that's the fundamental problem. Absolutely true that ethnic group, Jews, were discriminated against significantly and since their beginning and culminating in the horrors of the Holocaust. But those issues do not relate directly to Palestinians. In fact, you know, most of those were in Europe and Eastern Europe. And so the question becomes, for Palestinians, is why do Palestinians have to pay for the sins of Europeans? And what right do these immigrants in the last 100 years have to land for which Palestinians have lived on for centuries and millennia? So that's the fundamental core issue, where this one ethnic group, Jews, believe they have a right to a land that another person, another ethnic group has been on. And there were Jews too, part of the Palestinians. So it's not exclusively, it's the immigrant Jews that are the issue. So that's I think, very simple. And all this complexity that arises is the wake of the fundamental problem.
Alan, what would you say?
We have to decide whether we're going to begin with the fact that the Jews have a right to live in that a piece of territory. And I mean, you can go back to the Canaanite nations if you want to, but for whatever reason, the United Nations accepted the biblical narrative that the Jewish people have a right to this land. And the borders are not significant because even in the book of in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, you have two or three different definitions of what is the Holy Land. But we've never again been, I mean, depending upon what definition, but even, you know, even in biblical times, you know, we didn't live in all the land. And of course, one definition is the Tigris and Euphrates to the Nile. Wouldn't that be a headache? Like Israel wants Iran and Iraq and Syria and sure, and Afghanistan. Yeah, of course we do. And of course, you know, the propagandists use that to say, see, the Jews aren't just going to be happy with Lebanon to the Red Sea, the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. Again, even King David didn't succeed in occupying all of the land that was promised by God. When the British government offered the land to the Jewish people in the Balfour Declaration, and later when the United Nations designated part of the land for a Jewish state, so you know you got to start with whether you're in favor of a Jewish state or you're not in favor of a Jewish state in what the United Nations and the British government recognized as the rightful homeland of the Jewish people going back centuries. And Jews, of course, have lived there for 3,000 years plus. So if you begin by denying Jewish people their right to return to their homeland after 2,000 years of a general diaspora, then the conversation's over. But if you recognize that the Jewish people have a right to the land, and they recognized and they accepted the UN partition plan, whereas the Arab nations did not recognize it, and war broke out the day after the British left, you know, on May 15th, and Israel defended its right to have that land, the land that was designated to them. And again, I'm not sure Israel can be punished for, you know, the defending themselves and ending up with more land every time there was a war. And again, in 67, when the some of the surrounding Arab nations once again went to war, hoping to push the Jews into the sea.
Alec, what would you say?
Alan brought up an excellent point, and that is, you know, where does one start the historical line? He mentions the Canaanites, who preceded the Israelites. Abraham is Abraham of Ur, came from Mesopotamia. So that the Israelites were immigrants, and if you look up, you know, the Old Testament, you find all kinds of, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a historical document, but it describes many wars about taking over the land, so that, you know, one can say, yes, this is their land, but it wasn't before they arrived, and it wasn't after they were no longer there. So the question is really, where does one start the timeline? I think that's important, because I've been to the West Bank and people say, you know, we can trace our relations back to the Canaanites. So that's just one data point. So I'm definitely not saying that Jews shouldn't have a right to live on the land. The issue that I have is that they should not have the right to exclusively live on the land when there are also other peoples of that land. As to the Balfour Declaration, we hear a lot about the Balfour Declaration, and it's an important document. I think for the listeners, it's important to know some of the history. That was written in 1917, which was the end of World War I. In 1915 to 1916, which was more in the beginning and or middle of World War I, there's the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, which was a deal between the Sharif of Mecca, who represented the Arabs, and Sir McMahon, who was the British representative. And they agreed that the whole Arab Peninsula, with a few exceptions in northwestern Syria, for example, what's now known as northwestern Syria, would be self-determined by the Arabs after the war if the Arabs fought with the British against the Ottoman Empire. And 20,000 Arabs died in that war fighting for the British and beat the Ottoman Empire. And subsequently, many parts, the countries were established, were supposed self-rule of the Arabs. The exception was Palestine. And that's after the war, or at the sort of the ending of the war, 1917, is when the British issued this declaration that is in American textbooks about the Balfour Declaration, where it established a homeland, not a state, but a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. It also mentions not to affect negatively rights of the indigenous people as such. It's worded in a way that has been interpreted in different ways, so I won't say it's totally black and white. But the first question one has to ask is, did even Britain have the right to make that declaration? Because it wasn't their land. So that's just, I think it's important for people to consider that. The UN partition plan is discussed next. First of all, so the partition plan literally looks like a puzzle. There were three parts to the Arab majority state, which was, by the way, 98% Arab. And there were three parts to the Jewish majority state, which was only 55% Jewish and 45% Arab. And part of the UN partition plan, Resolution 181, adopted in 1947, established the rules that Jerusalem, for example, would be neither state, would be an international territory on its own, that equal rights for Jews and Palestinian Arabs would be honored in both states. So when one talks about the UN gave Jews Israel, that's not accurate. What it did was it defined a territory which has never been honored, that had a slight majority Jewish population, but required it to honor equal rights for all the people. So I think it's important for everybody to understand that the UN partition plan was never executed, was never honored by any party. I think it's important also to understand the way the UN partition plan was approved. Alan accurately mentioned that the Arab states did not approve it. Part of what happened at the UN in preparation is the Arab states asked for the General Assembly to take on the independence of Palestine, and the UN refused to take it to a vote and instead pursued the partition plan. So in the 19-teens, it was roughly 10% Jewish. And when under the British mandate, there was a massive, they allowed unlimited Jewish immigration. And the Jewish population soared after the Balfour Declaration until in 1947, when they did the partition plan, it was roughly a third of the population. So the two-thirds Arab, one-third Jewish. And the Arab population was both Muslim and Christian and Druze. And so what the Arabs continually asked for was an independent state, meaning Palestine, just get us out of the British mandate. And the Zionist movement did not want that because they would be a minority. And so the partition plan was aggressively pushed by the United States. There were a lot of politics involved in the U.S. election of Truman. But the bottom line is the United States threatened countries, including, for example, France, that if they did not support the partition plan, that the foreign aid after World War II would be cut off. And so there was a very much of an arm twisting that went on for the approval. The partition plan also was very problematic. As I mentioned, it was a jigsaw puzzle. There were three pieces to the Jewish majority state, including, for example, the Negev Nakab, which was 99% Arab, but it was a small population, but it was a lot of land, desert mostly. But nonetheless, 99% Arab population, that land became part of the Jewish state. In fact, of the three sections of the puzzle that became the Jewish majority state, two of them were majority Arab. So this is truly a gerrymandered partition plan. And the only reason I'm not disagreeing at all with Alan, I just want people to understand the context, because it sounds very simplistic that the Arabs rejected it as if there was no good reason. There are many, many reasons that anybody who is a majority population would have rejected.
You have been listening to a conversation between Alan Edelman, longtime professional in the Kansas City Jewish community, and Alex McDonald, human rights advocate and author of the book, When They Speak Israel, A Guide to Clarity in Conversations About Israel. In our next episode, we continue the conversation between Alan and Alex as they reflect on questions about terrorism, the blockade of Gaza since 2007, and Israel's occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem under military rule. Alan is co-hosting an interfaith group trip to Israel-Palestine. If you send me an email requesting information, I will forward your request to Alan. Write me at jamie.uip@gmail.com. Understanding Israel-Palestine is seeking a volunteer to assist with our website and podcast projects. To find out more, please email me at jamie.uip@gmail.com. That's jamie.uip@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.